powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
All right. Now, this time around, it's actually going to be fun. Not everything is pretty, but at least they got a win. So in the end, we will get there. Let's start at the beginning.
It's all that matters.
Let's start at the beginning with our plays of the game. The first big play of the game comes on a trick play. It looks like it's going to be a punt. The Seahawks offense, which has been 33%, a league low on third down.
Great job, guys. Way to start out.
Also doesn't get it done on third down again. So punt team comes out. Their first drive of the game. And there we go. Dixon about to punt again, and what's this?
Brandon Ayuk gonna fake. The fake is coming near side 40. Midfield is Travis Homer. 40. He's gonna go 30. He's running 20, 15, 10, 5. Flips into the end zone. Touchdown, Seahawks. 73 yards. Pull out all the stops on the first drive of the game. Score any way you can, and the Seahawks just did on a fake punt. Travis Homer, the up back, takes the snap, goes around the left side, and takes it 73. Had a blocker in front, cuts back inside, and he was gone.
A pure pandemonium. I mean, that was just absolutely insane. And, you know, you look at that play, one, I mean, immediately your mind goes to, I can't believe they called it right there, Stacy. I mean, on their own 23-yard line? Are you kidding me? If that doesn't work, I mean, that's a disaster. Sorry, 27-yard line. That's an absolute disaster.
Well, and it's fourth and six. So it's doable. It's a trick play. It's exciting.
But
it's a direct snap to Homer,
It's not
right.
The range that you would normally go for
it's
a fake.
The Seattle 27-yard line, fourth and six. Pete Carroll would never go for like a fourth down attempt at fourth and six from your 27-yard line.
Right. It's crazy, but it makes a lot of sense now when Pete Carroll talks through it that it was actually up to the players and not up to the coaching staff when they made that call. It was a look that they had pre-designed for, hey, if you get this specific look on the punt unit, then go ahead and call the fake, and it's going to work out well. And not only did it work out where you picked up the first down, Travis Homer takes it all the way for a touchdown. I mean, absolutely incredible. And, hey, if the offense is not going to get going and they're going to struggle, you got to find a way to score in any situation or any way that you possibly can.
All right, Pete Carroll, during the Pete Carroll Show with Mike Salk, talked about some of those plays he'd like back that got away from the team. This might have been one of them. The 49ers recover a fumble from Gerald Everett. They take over, and it's a 7-second scoring drive because on first and 10, Jimmy G finds George Kittle for 24 yards.
Single setback now, motions out of the backfield, and Garoppolo's going to throw. Stands, looks, going to throw to the end zone, got a man there. Touchdown, 49ers. And, man, there is a lot of 49er fans here today because there is a lot of noise. One play after the fumble recovery, and the Niners are a point away from tying this one up. A 24-yard touchdown strike.
It's frustrating when you turn over the ball in general, Stacy. It's a killer when it results directly into points. So the 49ers do a great job of taking their shot down the field. One play, bam, now it's 7-7. It's a tie ball game. Basically a new game from that point on, and the momentum that you had and you took, gone, right? Completely even now. And that's one of those plays, Stacy, with Kittle, where I cannot wait to watch the film and go back and see what happened there, because it was a complete bust in coverage, and it looked like DJ Reed wasn't fully aware of the responsibility that he had, and he thought he had more help from Quandre Diggs. So I'm very curious to see what they called on that particular play, but they were not on the same page, to say the least.
All right, well, the Seahawks offense tries to strike back, but they can't. They go three and out again. Michael Dixon punts it. San Francisco takes over. We're getting deep into the first quarter right now. And then you have Jimmy Garoppolo, okay? First and 10, San Francisco on their own 23-yard line. He throws over the middle. It's intended for Sherfield. Instead, it's intercepted by Bobby Wagner.
Garoppolo steps up, throws right down the middle. It's intercepted. Bobby Wagner with the pick. He's at the 30, sidesteps one man, knocked off his feet. Bobby Wagner, late flag comes in on the far side of the field. Bobby Wagner, his first interception of this season. Garoppolo, I don't think ever saw him. But you know what, Paul? You talked about it. Garoppolo loves to throw the ball to the middle of the field. The Seahawks know that.
Now, this is one of those interceptions that Jimmy Garoppolo gave two of them. Thank goodness. But this is an interception that you just go, oh my gosh, I can't believe he made that throw. But very clearly, he didn't see Bobby Wagner in the middle of the field. He thought he had a wide open receiver that was streaking open off of play action. Bobby Wagner was right there, and honestly, one of the easiest interceptions of his entire career.
Now, we didn't end up saving this as a highlight because it most certainly wasn't. But Seattle gives their offense, Bobby Wagner gives the Seahawks offense a chance to strike. They take over at the San Francisco 28-yard line, so they're just outside of the red zone, okay? Then they move backwards. It's a 10-yard holding penalty on Will Dissly. Then Wilson is sacked for a loss of 11. He fumbles. Ethan Postick recovers it at the Seattle 39. Right now you're facing, Jake, a second and 43. Could we talk about this drive?
Second and 43?
How did we get here?
I don't understand what... What's there to talk about?
Everyone loves adversity. I wish Russell Wilson would have been like, you know what? I honestly feel like I perform better at a second and 43 than I do at a second and five.
Oh, man. I wish that that was the case, but this was one of those moments where I just wanted to throw anything and everything in my house because here you are given this golden opportunity here with this interception, and you don't even get points out of it. I mean, this should be a touchdown opportunity here, and it's anything but. But when you look at first and 20, okay, you're first and 20, you get pushed back. That is an awful place to be on a holding call. But Stacey, Russell didn't even have any time. You look at this offensive line; it was a complete and utter collapse from the get go. He fumbled, you know, trying to throw the ball, fumbles it out, and now you're at second and 43. My goodness, and now you're just trying to play for a field goal. I honestly was very surprised that Pete Carroll went for the field goal here, 56 yards out. I know Jason Myers has a strong leg, but I was very surprised in that moment when, you know, you got an opportunity to pin them back deep in their own territory. You go for a field goal instead. And Jason Myers wasn't even close on this.
No, and
that
I don't blame
shocking.
Jason Myers on that field goal. It was a long one. It's the north end zone, which has been wonky. Lots of teams missing that one. And I would blame Myers or put more blame on Myers if the offensive drive before that hadn't been so awful. You could have just taken a knee and been like, we're going to kick a field goal from here. And you would have had a better shot at adding points.
Dude,
at that point.
That was just absolutely absurd.
All right, so the first quarter, Seattle nets about 5 total offensive yards. They have negative 10 passing yards. They have 80 net yards, but don't forget about that 73-yarder from Travis Homer. So that's pretty much all they have. Offensively, they're
doing
nothing.
I love that goes into your rushing stats.
Thank you. Finally, they get it going. Now, it starts with a 12-yard completion to DK Metcalf. Seattle's on the move now. Adrian Peterson converts a third down, as does the rest of the Seahawks offensive line. Just a moving wall of people. A couple more plays, and then Russ finds DK for 33 yards.
Homer in the backfield, four-man rush, and here comes the shot. Metcalf, downfield, reaches out, makes the catch. He's down at the 2-yard line between the safety and the cornerback. Just what you saw. Russell Wilson, and he takes a line shot down the right side. DK Metcalf lays out and makes the catch.
This was into double coverage.
It was, and that throw, that catch was beautiful. I mean, I don't think people really understand how hard it is just to throw a go ball, an inside go ball. So what do I mean by that? Normally when you throw a go ball, a fade ball, it is over the outside shoulder. It is him or nobody onto the sideline. It's a low percentage throw, but it's not high risk necessarily because it's either going to be the receiver or it's going to be out of bounds or incomplete, right? When you throw it inside, because that's the route that DK had to take and that's the leverage he had, so he took, you know, best release possible, takes the inside leverage. You have to beat the safety with the throw, and then you have the corner on the back of the receiver. The margin for error is none, and Russell puts it perfectly where DK can get it before the safety can get there with the corner not being able to make the play. And DK goes down and makes a really nice diving catch to be able to complete that and make that happen. Third and 14. Odds aren't in your favor, and it was incredibly frustrating to see them get backed up, a delay of game penalty, but then to see them convert and get themselves into the low red zone, get them to the four-yard line. I mean, Stacey, that was huge.
And after that, it's chaos. Adrian Peterson gets a one-yard touchdown. Then Jimmy G finds George Kittle, who runs down the sideline, tightrope run for a 48-yard touchdown. Russ finds D. Eskridge for a 7-yard touchdown. It's back and forth, back and forth. Then it looks like the Seahawks are going to get another touchdown.
That was
Gerald Everett bobbles a pass. It's picked off by Williams at the goal line. Jimmy G drops back into the end zone for the Seahawks. It looks like the 49ers are going to be driving down the field again. And then this happens.
Garoppolo, 5 yards deep in the end zone. He gets it. He goes down. It's going to be a safety. It's going to be a safety for the Seahawks. Carlos Dunlap, where have you been, my friend? What a day to come on and grab Garoppolo and throw him down to the ground for a safety. And it is tied up 23 apiece.
Yeah, that was pure pandemonium, Stacey. I mean, the emotions from being frustrated and so mad at Gerald Everett. Having that touchdown in his hands, I mean, that changes the game big time. You go up with the lead and you gain a lot of momentum. And then to have that turn into an interception, Carlos Dunlap, his role has been limited to basically just a sack specialist on third downs with those opportunities. Carlos Dunlap's been frustrated. He's made that very public. But taking advantage of that moment and getting Jimmy Garoppolo down with the safety, did any of you think or worried? Were you worried that it was going to get called back, that it was going to be a penalty on Dunlap?
I wondered because it looked for a minute like he might have grabbed the face mask because it was just the shoulder pad.
Yes.
So at first I was worried, but then I was like, no, that's fine. That's clean.
Right. He was up by the head area, but so I thought maybe there's a chance. You never know with these, you know, these penalties that are happening on quarterbacks these days, but it was clean. It was beautiful.
There's another play I was worried would get called. That's going to be this one.
The play fake. Garoppolo looks, throws to the end zone. Ball is knocked away in the back of the end zone, intended for Trent Sherfield. It looked like he had a shot to make the catch, but Sidney Jones was right there to break it up. And now it comes down to a fourth and goal from the three for the Niners.
There were seconds left in the game at that point. You're looking at 27 seconds left on the clock. Sidney Jones breaks up the pass. San Francisco 49ers fans after the game. Not only was Nick Bosa saying the refs weren't on their side, but fans were saying, that was pass interference. What are you doing? But that's DPI. But no, I think that was about as close as you could get. But it was a perfect example of
classic,
when refs. I know I'm saying this as a Seattle radio host, but this was a perfect example of when refs should not decide a game.
It is an example of when not to decide a game. And quite honestly, down there at the goal line in those situations, it gets handsy. Guys get grabby. They push off. There's a lot that you get away with down there. And honestly, when I'm watching Sidney Jones, yes, he has his hands on him. Yes, he's plastered to him. But at no point in time does he really grab the jersey, does he pull, or take the receiver off of his path. That is the most important aspect of it. And if he had done any of those things, I think he gets the flag drawn on him, mm-hmm. but he doesn't. And so that, to me, was the main reason why they didn't throw a flag. And so I thought, honestly, it was a good physical play down there on the goal line.
There's 22 seconds left in the game. Jimmy Garoppolo drops back. It's now or never for the San Francisco 49ers. And who comes up big? Of course, it's Carlos Dunlap.
With a single setback, Garoppolo looks. Ball is tipped up in the air. It's going to fall to the ground. The Seahawks are going to win this football game. The fourth and three pass was tipped at the line of scrimmage. I don't know who tipped it, but I want to go down and shake that man's hand. I might have been Dunlap. And on fourth down and goal from the three, the Seahawks take over, and they'll have one knee, and this game will be over. And the Seahawks will break a losing streak that has been unlike anything the Seahawks and their fans have seen in the last decade.
I mean, that was awesome. And I love Rabel. Gosh, he's the best. I love his calls. He always shows up for the big moments. But Carlos Dunlap, again, coming up big. And honestly, this is the time where you look at him and you're like, where have you been all season long? And I do believe in Carlos Dunlap and when he says, I'm frustrated by the way that my role has been changed, the lack of reps that I've been getting. I do believe that that has affected his ability to make plays as often as we've seen him make. But when he got his chances yesterday, he made the most of it. And classic Carlos Dunlap with his long wingspan, Stacey, knocking that ball down. And that is exactly why he was re-signed, to make these types of plays. And it was fun to see him do it.
All right, those were our plays of the game. Guys, don't forget, you can watch the show live on 710sports.com/video. Let's head to Four Down Territory.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass. Going inside the game with quarterback guru, Jake Heaps.
Jake Heaps played in the NFL, played quarterback, was in the room with him, was in the fire. He's really a guru. He really played the game.
First down, Jake, what did you make of Russell Wilson's performance yesterday?
I mean, I thought he played extremely well yesterday. He wasn't perfect. There were two deep balls to DK Metcalf, one that was really obvious in the second half that sailed over his head and out of bounds that, gosh, if he makes that play, that's huge. There's another one earlier in the first quarter. It just seemed like him and DK were a little off in the low red zone. There was an opportunity for a touchdown there that Russell threw more towards the back of the end zone, where I think DK was anticipating more of a ball thrown on him. So a little bit of miscommunication early, just a plain miss by Russell Wilson in the second half there. Outside of that, I thought Russell played brilliantly. I thought he played an extremely well-rounded game, you know, throwing the deep crossers that we know, getting the deep shots down the field, throwing beautiful touch passes into the end zone. Overall, I thought he looked great and looked more like himself, the Russell Wilson that we all know and love. He also used the short aspect of the field, the quick game, and that was great to see. He made it confident throws. One of my favorite throws of the game is hitting a quick pass to Tyler Lockett over the middle of the field, where he beat very tight window coverage. And that, to me, was a sign of him seeing the field, feeling the coverage, reacting quickly, making good decisions. And that is something that we just have not seen from Russell Wilson in quite some time before that finger injury. So that was great to see. And quite honestly, Stacey, to see him have that performance with the offensive line performing as bad as they did throughout the entire game, that was extremely impressive, because Russell Wilson got hit over and over and over again, and despite that, continued to stay in there and made really good decisions throughout the game.
Speaking of the offense, second down. What did the offense do that made it function better? Because they looked ugly early, and not just earlier in this game. I'm talking about this year. They looked bad.
They did. But people kept rolling their eyes when Russell Wilson was pointing to tempo, 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 tempo. And, oh, we've heard this conversation before. And Shane Waldron even alluded to, you know, hey, we got to convert on third downs, and then we can get to more some of the tempo stuff. Well, you were able to convert some more third downs. But even to start drives on first and second and third down, I don't know if you guys noticed this, but they played with a lot more tempo. They played with a lot more urgency. They got onto the ball a lot faster, and it really softened up the 49ers. It did not allow them to get into a lot of the pressure packages that they wanted to get into. And then it also made the Seahawks easy to identify. It made the job easier for Russell Wilson and the offensive line to identify where some of those pressures were coming from. So I thought they did a much better job implementing their tempo in a variety of different ways, where they just got on the ball faster. Muddle huddles, and the tempo was crisp and clean outside of a few times where they ran the clock all the way down. I thought they did an excellent job with that, and that made their running game better, made their passing game better, and it just put the 49ers more on their heels rather than allowing them to be the aggressor and dictate the terms of the game.
Third down. Let's quickly jump back to that Sidney Jones play. 49ers fans woke up crying today. They didn't get a DPI call. Did the Seahawks get away with one?
No, I don't believe that they did. I think Sidney Jones played that really well. And me being a quarterback and an offensive guy, I would tell you right away if I thought that was DPI, just even if it wasn't in the Seahawks' favor. You see those plays happen all the time down the goal line. Guys get away with it, especially more in the middle. If it's a fade ball, I think refs are quicker to throw the flag. But when it's stuff that's happening in the middle of the field, in the middle of the goal line, the end zone, you see a lot of contact that doesn't get called in those moments. And Sidney Jones never pulled, never tugged at the defender. He had his hands all over him, But that, to me, is something that more goes along with the game in that situation. And even when Jimmy Garoppolo threw the football, Sidney Jones made a good play on the ball. He was not grabbing the receiver.
Yeah, more hand fighting than really anything else.
Yes.
Fourth down. Seahawks limited the 49ers to just 71 yards on the ground. How did they do that?
Well, they implemented the beef package, is what I'm going to call it.
The beef boys.
Brian Monet, Al Woods, Puna Ford, they saw a lot of action. Quite frankly, they've been doing this a lot to really kind of round out their defensive line and to really be committed to try to stop the run, which has taken time away from people like Carlos Dunlap, Benson Mayowa, Kerry Hyder Jr. They have been really committed to trying to stop the run and have that beef package there for them. And I thought that those three guys played a really good game, particularly Al Woods and Brian Monet. And that was a big reason why they were able to slow down the running game and the running attack for the San Francisco 49ers. When you don't have Deebo Samuel on the field, you don't necessarily need speed out there on the field to track him down. You can be more isolated and focus more solely on the traditional run game.
There were multiple plays where I thought, oh, Al Woods was in on that one. He did a great job, especially what was what was the play? I think it was a fourth down attempt. It wasn't a sneak. It was
the zone read play?
Yes.
That they ended up calling false start on?
And I was like, what? Why?
It was a terrible call by Shanahan in that moment. I didn't understand it. And then they get bailed out because Alex Mack fumbles the ball at the center position. So that to me was a bummer. That was a missed opportunity for the Seahawks as well to get the ball in their plus territory rather than the 49ers being able to punt the football. But I thought they did an outstanding job handling the run game all game long. And that was very, very impressive, knowing that the 49ers, that's exactly what they wanted to get to. And that is a big reason why they've been able to go on a 3-game winning streak before entering that game.
As a reminder, it is Monday. Not sure if you guys knew that, but it also means that every Monday and Friday on Jake and Stacey, we open up phone lines. That is coming up later at 1 p.m. So get ready for that. I'll give you the number to call. I'll give you the question, all that good stuff coming up at 12:45 before we get to any of that. As a reminder, we are talking about the Kraken. They are facing off against the Penguins tonight at 7 p.m. And they're also coming off a 4-3 win over Edmonton. Lots of good stuff. Marissa and Jemmy of the Seattle Times going to join us in about 15 minutes. Before we get to that, though, another superstar calls for the Sonics' return to Seattle. That's next.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacey.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
This is The Timeline on Jake and Stacey, reading you the top stories you're going to see on your own timelines. As a reminder, this hour is brought to you by Muckleshoot Casino. We'll start with this one. Yes, it has nothing to do, with a Seattle pro sports team, but it doesn't matter because it's a really wild story. The Garfield girls basketball team beat Cleveland High School by the final score of... Does anyone want to take a guess?
Okay. Was it close?
Well,
like
it
a four-overtime thriller?
It's not going to be close if it made the timeline.
It's not going to be close because the timeline is for weird stories. Take a guess at the point difference.
Okay.
Okay?
I'm
30.
30-point difference? Jake.
I am going to take a wild guess because this is the timeline.
Yeah.
I'm going to say 80 to 15.
80 to 15. Okay. Well, I mean, that's close. Okay.
It's close?
Final score? 112 to 2.
Ooh.
What?
112 to 2?
Here's the thing. You got to like 60 to 2, and you were like,
more.
Double up.
Oh my gosh.
We're running the full court press.
Run the table.
Oh, my word. 112 to 2.
I don't know.
Threes up 70.
Yes.
I just feel awful. I mean, you know that they probably, and I would hope that the Garfield girls basketball coach put in all the backups. By the time you got to like 60 to 2, and you can't stop them, you can't tell them to not score. I mean, at least that's what I'm hoping. I hope they're not putting up the full court press and, you know, doing all that junk with their starters. That would be messed up. But, man, gosh, you just feel for those poor girls at Cleveland High School.
My point deficit like that kind of also falls on the referees, because I've refereed youth basketball before, and we were told that if a game gets to more than a 20-point difference between the winner and loser,
yeah,
just keep the clock running. Don't stop it for timeouts. Don't stop it for free throws. Don't stop it for inbounds plays. just keep the clock running, get the game over with as quickly as possible. I don't think that happened at all here.
Oh my gosh.
112-2. 100 points wasn't even enough to satisfy Garfield. They won by 110 points. Only allowed one basket.
That is awful.
I also just wonder, like, if you are, I don't know how, if you're the, you don't want to tell players, like, stop trying. But I don't know. There's an aspect of sportsmanship that's kind of lost here. As much as I'm making fun of him, I'm like, what are you doing?
But maybe. But you don't know. I mean, we don't know if the, like I said, maybe the girls' basketball coach for Garfield took out all the starters a long time ago, and you've got the backups, and they're in, they're doing their thing. I mean, at some point, there's really not a whole lot you can do other than making sure the clock is running and do your best to just let the game play the way it is. I mean, you know, we had that sometimes at Skyline where, you know, in high school, where we were blowing out teams and we would take out the starters and you'd put in the JV guys and sometimes maybe even freshmen. And if they're still scoring, there's nothing that you can do.
Now, there is a photo of the scoreboard at one point of the final, the end of it. And I was staring at it like, is this Photoshopped? Is it Photoshopped? And I tried to click on the sports book or scorebook live to try to see if I could read it. It's just the whole thing is just, man, it's wild. All right, next story here. I said that another superstar, was calling for the return of the Sonics to Seattle. That superstar is Klay Thompson. Here's what he said.
Bring back our Sonics. Seattle deserves a team. Give Seattle our team back. Bring back our Sonics.
Keeping it simple on an Instagram video from Klay Thompson. The message, very obvious, and honestly, I'm not mad at it.
He was on his boat all by himself, Instagram live.
Why?
And that's all he had to say.
You know what? And I respect it. I want to know what came to his mind where he was like, was he having a conversation? Was it just like, you know what? That's just my regular reminder to bring back our Sonics.
Yeah. I'm going to pander to this Pacific Northwest.
Pander?
Right now. Yeah.
Not pandering. He's probably legitimately a Sonics fan. He's a Coug.
No, I'm sure he is. I'm sure he is. And I'm not going to disagree with him. And I don't care what it is. But to hear a prominent player in the NBA like Klay Thompson going out and putting this out there, I mean, obviously, he's not the first one. Kevin Durant has said this. I mean, everybody in the NBA feels this way. And yet the NBA itself does nothing to remedy the situation.
No.
They're in no hurry to remedy the situation right now, which is another reason why I hate the NBA, and it drives me insane that they let this happen to begin with. Drives me insane that they don't have more urgency to bring back bring back basketball to Seattle, and everybody wants it. Everybody wants it to happen. They know it's the right thing to do, and yet they don't do it. So it'll be a great day when it does, but until then, Klay Thompson, you continue to make yourself a fan favorite here in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, I love Klay Thompson. I love the way he plays the game. I love his approach, and you know, knowing that he's behind the Sonics makes me like him.
Have
even
we
more.
All just accepted? And Curtis, is a question for you too, that there is just going to be an aspect of stubbornness with the NBA that they refuse to admit how financially horrible decision this was to remove a team from Seattle,
yes.
And they are now making it as difficult as they possibly can to bring one back.
Seattle's going
to
be used like LA was for all those years.
Well,
by
that's
the
exactly
NFL.
Right. It also like, gives hey, them yes. a negotiating, a bargaining weapon for certain things.
Yeah.
But also, it's like they refuse to do it because then it would be admitting a mistake.
Correct.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They, like I said, there are all the right reasons to do it. And then there is stubbornness and refusing to admit that there was legitimate fault and that they wronged the city. And I think that is a huge reason why they continue to drag their feet through this process. And look, having Climate Pledge Arena, having that be successful with the NHL, that's one positive step, one more positive step towards bringing back the Sonics to Seattle.
Last wait, story here. Oh,
before we get to the last story, yeah. Did you guys see the pictures of Climate Pledge this weekend with Gonzaga, Alabama, and just how
yes.
cool that arena looked with the basketball
yeah.
floor? That's the first time we've ever seen basketball
yes.
get played there.
Right.
That is true. That
out.
Is very true.
Last story here on the timeline. A snowstorm in Denmark left 31 people stranded in an IKEA showroom. They spent the night sleeping on the display furniture. Sounds a little uncomfortable, but my question for you guys, if you could be trapped in any one store overnight with access to whatever you wanted, where would you be trapped? And why is it a Cinnabon?
Well, I mean,
Curtis?
If you're well,
Cinnabon,
if you're looking for comfort, if you're looking for comfort in a stranded situation, IKEA is the place to be, right?
Okay, IKEA is great.
But didn't when you guys were little? Didn't you always used to think like, oh, what if I just got to go to the mall overnight?
Sure,
get stuck in like a KB Toys or something.
That'd be amazing. But the place that I would probably pick hands down to be stranded.
Dave and Buster's.
No, I'm not going to say Dave and Buster's, although that would be pretty awesome. My kids would be pretty pumped about that. would be Costco.
Oh, yeah.
Costco has everything.
And they've got furniture.
Everything.
Oh, you're right. They do have furniture.
Yeah.
Stacey, what?
I know.
Of course they have furniture. They've got couches. They've got beds. They've got everything.
I already apologized.
What are you thinking?
I'm sorry.
They've got toys. They've got clothes. They've got food. I mean, you name it. They've got it.
They're like, sir.
That is the perfect place.
Sir, it's 3 p.m. You are not actually locked in this store. We're going to have to ask that you stop eating all of our food.
It's a 50-degree day outside.
I'm sorry. This pumpkin pie, it's just delicious. I can't help myself. You know, like if there was a zombie apocalypse or something like that, there was no place I would rather be than Costco. Like, just let me just set up base in a Costco,
I will
survive.
You can
anything.
Get your tires changed too while you're there.
Exactly.
You need
yes.
a couch? Need new tires? That's the
yes.
place to go.
Need new batteries, flashlights? You name it. They
there
got it.
There are two things I have never heard you speak more passionately about in my life. Number one, Skyline football.
Go Spartans.
And number two, Costco.
I mean, yeah, what's not to love?
Okay, all right.
What's not to love? Other than the fact that you walk out of there and you're paying an arm and a leg for everything. But, hey, you get it in bulk.
I think a proper Jake-ism, Curtis, is you're paying a farm and a leg. That's exactly what's happening. Coming up next, the Kraken are taking on the Penguins tonight at 7 p.m. For a little bit of a preview and to look at where the Kraken are right now, it's Marissa and Jemmy of the Seattle Times. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Don't forget, you can listen to Jake and Stacey on the go or catch up with the show if you miss it. Subscribe to the Jake and Stacey podcast. It's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please don't forget to rate and review if you do subscribe. Joining us right now to talk about the Kraken, it's Marissa and Jemmy of the Seattle Times. She's on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline. Marissa, how's it going?
I'm great. How are you guys?
We're well. I mean, the Kraken certainly playing some really great hockey of late. There's still been ups and downs, but we're seeing by far their most successful stretch. I mean, what's been working for them over these last, let's say, 5 to 7 games?
Yeah, it's kind of wild because the teams they're beating are some of the best teams in the league. They got out of their 6-game losing streak by beating the Capitals, who have been one of the best teams in the league for years. They beat the Florida Panthers in Florida. They just beat the Oilers on home ice a couple of nights ago. They've been doing this with their captain, Mark Giordano, in COVID protocol. Jordan Eberle and Jaden Schwartz, their leading scorers, have been out of the lineup. So it's been kind of wild. This is where they're finding their success. So I think it's just they've been together as a group for a little while now, and some things are just starting to work that earlier on in the year, either they didn't know what to do in those situations or that chemistry just hadn't come together yet. But they're starting to play like a team where their passes are crisper. They know where they're going to be on the ice. It just seems like the buy-in is there, and it's starting to come together the way they projected a little bit.
Marissa, how big of an impact has the injuries have been? Because they have yet really to be a fully healthy team at this point, dealing with different people on and off the ice. How much has that impacted them, and how big of that has that been a challenge for them to overcome?
Yeah, you have to think a little bit just because it's a group that, until this year, they've never been together as it is. So it took until, I think it was about 10, 12 games in for Colin Blackwell to play his first game, and they'd already all come together a little bit. Yarncroke was out for a bit, and now he's out again on injured reserve. So it's definitely difficult for them as a group who's never really been together. They had, I think 40 minutes of being a fully healthy team on the ice before Yarncroke got hurt in the third period of the Carolina game, and that was about it. And their goaltending too, Drieger being out on IR multiple times this year, they definitely have to have an impact. So you look across the league, kind of everyone's dealing with that a little bit. You have the Colorado Avalanche, one of the best teams in the league, and they've been slowed down by a bunch of injuries. The Golden Knights as well, Mark Stone's been out, Jonathan Marchessault, a lot of their really good players. So, and then COVID's kind of affected everyone in the league, right? So, It's kind of been a unique year in that sense of we can't really get a read of the playoff picture because teams have been missing so many key components. So that's kind of been true of the Kraken as well. But in this last stretch where they've been without some of their key players, they've definitely weathered the storm very well.
What's all this talk about revenge games when it comes to playing against the Penguins?
Yeah, I mean, for the Kraken, they have one almost every night. The entire team is made up of guys who were on other teams last year. So, and for a lot of them, when they were taken in the expansion draft, it means that their former team left them protected. So tonight, with the Kraken playing the Penguins left Brandon Tanev to be selected. They traded away Jared McCann to Toronto for him to get selected. So they essentially told those guys they didn't need them, and now they're facing their former team. We saw the other night Adam Larson scored a goal against the Oilers, a team that left him unprotected. Driedger shut down the Panthers, a team that let him go. So there's definitely a little extra motivation in a season like this. We saw it with the Golden Knights a few years ago, their first year in the league, where every single night, basically, you have guys going up against a team that said, we don't really need you that badly. So there's a little extra motivation from that for sure. And especially in this upcoming stretch, some of the teams they're playing, we're going to start to see it a little bit more.
All right, let's talk about Pittsburgh quickly. That game tonight at 7. How do these two match up?
Yeah, the Penguins, I mean, historically, they've been one of the best teams in the NHL for a while. Sidney Crosby is one of the best players in the league, and the Kraken are coming off a game where they had to play against Leon Draisaitl and Connor McDavid on the Oilers, who are similar types of just superstars. They're going to dodge a bullet not having to deal with Evgeny Malkin, the other star for the Penguins, who's been out. He skated today in a non-contact jersey, so he won't be in. The Penguins are in a little bit of a free fall for a little bit there. They lost 3 games in a row, but then they beat the Canucks, which is a team that's just kind of been all over the place. But as of now, the Penguins are a playoff team. Tristan Jarry, their goalie, has been playing pretty well after a rough go of it in the playoffs last year. So they're a dangerous team, but the Kraken have done a very good job against tough teams like this. So we'll see how they do. They've done pretty decently against teams out east of late, but the Kraken are playing really well, and I think right now they're kind of taking that challenge head-on facing these really tough teams.
Marissa, how big of a turnaround has this team, you know, the success they've had with the improved play at goaltending for the Kraken?
Yeah, that's been huge. And, I mean, Philip Grubauer got off to a rough start. Still, his statistics rank pretty low among goaltenders in the league, but that doesn't really reflect the way he's been playing since basically the Carolina game. He's been really sharp. And if you look at his trends historically, when he gets going on a new team, he was a backup in Washington, a backup in Colorado, became a starter in Colorado. It takes him a little bit. So this has kind of been on brand for him to just take a little bit to get going. But I mean, when he's on, he was a Vezina finalist for a reason last year. He can be one of the best goalies in the league. Kind of some bad luck for them that Driedger got hurt when it started to seem like he was really starting to get going. He played really well in Florida, goes into Buffalo to play very well. They gave him the back-to-back starts for the first time this season, and then he gets hurt again. So that's pretty bad luck. But the goaltending has definitely stepped it up, and that's been really important for the Kraken.
Hey, Marissa, the Kraken are obviously great with NHL analytics, and I know that you're great with analytics. You mention it often. So maybe for an audience that isn't as familiar, is there one particular aspect of the Kraken's game that you think tells a big story about how this team has been playing? It could be good, it could be bad, but just something to kind of let people dip their toe into analytics.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the Kraken have been pretty good at controlling puck possession, and there's a few different stats for that. But even when they've been losing games earlier on, they've had a lot of chances. I mean, you can call it puck luck or whatever, where the puck just wasn't going in for them. But for the most part, they're a team that really can control possession of the puck, expected goals for, which is a stat that basically tells you shot quality, like the percentage of high-quality shots in or per game, per period, or per season, or whatever. If you look at that for the Kraken traditionally, it's been pretty well. A high-danger stat I cite a lot of the time is high-danger goals and high-danger chances. And earlier on in the year, the Kraken were allowing a lot of high-danger chances. That's slowed down dramatically, and I think a part of that is just the defense coming together, and a high-danger chance is basically any goal-scoring opportunity below the circles, below the face-off dots. It's kind of judged differently by every NHL team, but that's an area where the Kraken have done a really good job starting to limit that and getting chances themselves, so that number's not up for them, getting chances and preventing others. But, yeah, the Kraken are a team that were built based on a lot of analytics, and it's really tough early on in the season to get a sample size because it takes about 20 games to really get a feel sometimes for those numbers, but a lot of them have started to get better for the Kraken, and that's something they're definitely keeping an eye on.
All right, she is Marissa Njemi of the Seattle Times covering the Kraken for them. Marissa, thank you so much for joining us. From, I'm assuming, Climate Pledge, based on you and Andy Ide, someone we also talked to, I'm assuming you guys just live there now. You always have to be there.
Basically, it feels like it.
Awesome, awesome. All right. We appreciate it. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Marissa.
Thank you.
I almost called Marissa Kraken at the end. Did you guys hear that?
Hey, Kraken.
Thanks
how
so
you
much,
doing?
Kraken. I don't know what. It's just the word.
I wonder how she would have reacted to that.
I don't know, Jake. I don't want to know. I'm glad that I didn't do that. All right. Coming up, we're going to take a look around the NFL. We're also taking your calls at 1 p.m. As a reminder, before we get to any of that, though, let's look back at this Seahawks win and figure out those smaller moments, the things that caught our eye. That's next.